Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Haris Salat, who is a journalist and the owner of two popular Japanese restaurants, Ganso Ramen and Ganso Yaki in Brooklyn. Hello, Haris. Welcome
to
the show.
Thank you for having me today, Akiko.
Okay, so we'll talk about your amazing Japanese restaurants in a moment, but first, could you tell us how you got into food business? Because I heard that you worked as a dairy farmer, bread baker, and a cook.
I failed in so many things. So, you know, it's the last, you know, it's kind of the default choice after you failed in so many other things. You can always work in a restaurant.
Right. But there must be no reason, right, to be a dairy farmer. I wouldn't have done it.
No, I loved farming. That was really a lot of fun. And I've been cooking for a long time, and I started to work as a cook in my 20s in New York. Mm. And actually, I was taking some classes, cooking classes, and in a place that doesn't exist anymore. And it was I could do it for free if I helped clean up afterwards and just kind of do all that stuff, which was fine with me. I, you know, I've washed many a dish. And then I started to know the chef, and one of his cooks broke his arm, and he's like, hey, do you want to work in my restaurant? So that's how I started cooking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, but lucky you.
Yeah, well, you know.
Right. Then you became a journalist in 1991 and right. Reported for Associated Press Radio, produced TV news at CBS News and CNBC, and worked in the internet media. So what made you change?
Foolish decision. Now, you know, I was working as a cook, and I have a dear friend of mine from high school who's actually been a television reporter in a long time in New York, and his wife, who was a TV news producer, and they kept telling me that I'd really enjoy journalism. And I had this Robert Frost moment, you know, which road to take. The chef I was working for wanted to recommend me to another restaurant to keep developing as a cook. And at the same time, that couple were encouraging me to get into the news business. And I decided to get into the news business at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then eventually you became more into storytelling, travel, and good eats, and then wrote many articles for great red media such as New York Times, Savoir, and Gourmet Magazine. So what kind of shift did you make?
It's funny where life takes you, but I think I came full circle in my 40s to I had the tools to tell a story, to investigate things, and writing about something is a way to learn about it. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself writing about food, which I've always been interested in. I never stopped cooking, and that kind of took over my life, I guess. And I started to work really to write a lot about food, and ended up writing cookbooks and all that other stuff. Mm. It was a way to marry the two interests of mine professionally.
Right. Yeah. Sounds like it was supposed to happen and it happened.
I guess so.
Right. And what did you write about?
Well, I started writing about a lot of different food culture, things that interested me. I did stories on Darjeeling tea. I went to India with a friend of mine. I wrote some stuff about Spain. I started writing things about Japan, but I never had a plan to get that deeply interested in Japanese cuisine or food. Mm. You were talking about in your introduction, I think I was like most Americans, I really didn't have a lot of idea about what Japanese cuisine was. Mm. But when I was a TV news producer in Washington, D.C. for a spell, I hated Washington, D.C. Sorry, people from Washington. And I started, I wanted to be back in New York, whatever. And then I started going to the Sackler Freer Gallery at the Smithsonian. And it turned out that there were these amazing shows put on by a curator who I've since become friends with. So I always say she was like the Adam Smith, the invisible hand that pushed me into Japan. But she did all that. She was incredible authority on pottery. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about Japanese pottery, but it really spoke to me. I love that natural form, and it was functional art, and it kind of blew me away. And I thought, man, I'm just going to go to Japan and go to a pottery village and check it out and learn more about Japanese pottery. And I did, and I went to this little town in Yamaguchi Prefecture called Hagi, which is a fishing village on the Sea of Japan, not in the sea. And it's also famous for pottery, very famous. And
right. Hagiaki means people really like, wow, it's Hagiaki. That's amazing.
It was really interesting, right? And I just showed up there. It was in the middle of winter, and it was I got to the train station when I arrived in Hagi, and I think people were freaked out. Like, what's this American guy doing there? And they told me to wait because I didn't speak a lick of Japanese in this very, kind of this gentleman came up after a while and he spoke English and he said he was the school teacher. He taught high school English at Hagi High School, Fast Times at Hagi High. But he asked me, he's like, what are you doing in Hagi? And I said, hey, I want to check out the pottery. Mm-hmm. And of course, anyway, it was kind of crazy, but there was an inn that was closed for the winter, but he got the innkeeper to open it, and I stayed there. And the pottery was amazing, but also what really blew me away was just eating Japanese food that wasn't sushi, it wasn't what I, heard about in America, or teriyaki, or things like that, or even ramen, which I had in New York. But it was just this incredible, country cooking that in some very odd way like reminded me of the food that my grandmother would cook, with a lot of root vegetables and fish and really hearty. And we'd go to the same restaurant every day, and these like two Japanese grandmas would yell at me because I didn't eat enough rice, and I'm like, just like my grandmother. So and that's really what got me interested. I'm like, man, this is wildly different than anything I thought and I knew about. And in fact, I was really surprised when I first went to Japan that you didn't really see sushi in any corner. It was kind of like it's a little tiny part of the cuisine that is so odd that it's become such a calling card of Japanese cooking. But so that launched, me in this direction of getting interested in Japanese cuisine.
When was it? Which year?
99 maybe, something okay. around there. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, 98, I don't remember.
And did you write an article about that?
No, I didn't. I just did it really for myself. And let's get the violins out. And, you know, I used to work at Sports Illustrated, and they always talked about athletes have, like, they were soaring high, and then something happened, and, you know, they broke their leg, and, they had this crash, and then they climbed back up. There's always the same story in Sports Illustrated. So I'll tell you the same story. I was working as a journalist, then I had cancer, and I was out for a couple of years. Mm. And then when I came back, and the funny thing, you know, when you have that happen to you, I mean, you know, theoretically the heavens are supposed to part. You had this mortality moment, and, you know, you're inspired and all this other stuff. And I the heavens didn't really part, but it did offer me, and it kind of surprised me that I got some more clarity. And you were saying about, you know, kind of bringing together the journalism and the food stuff. Mm. It really did kind of, you know, you live more immediately, I'd say. And I felt like, okay, this is what I'm interested, you know, the hell with everything else. I'm going to focus on stuff that I care about. And, you know, and I started getting into it. And by then I had gone to Japan a few more times. And then I thought, okay, let me just pitch some stories and maybe I can get in there.
Right. So what's special about, you know, reporting through food, you know, the culture through food for you?
I mean, look. Talking about food could be as, you know, as interesting as talking about plumbing. If you're a plumber, it's interesting. But, you know, it's the people, like, especially as Americans, we communicate through stories of people. And those were really interesting stories that I encountered there. And it was this kind of totally unknown thing. I agree with you in your intro. Even today, I think that it's kind of amazing to me, but Japanese food is really, you know, not so widely understood, you know.
Right. It's interesting because then, you know, you went to Yamaguchi, Hagi, and the more you get away from Tokyo, you see more local, sustainable. Yeah. And, you know, that food trend is now universal.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's true. There's a chef that I have become friends with over the last, you know, 15 years or whatever, this gentleman who every morning he gets up and he lives in Kyoto, and there he goes to these mountains north of Kyoto, and he picks wild greens and he buys all his vegetables from all these.
I know you're talking about. You got the Nakahigashi.
Yeah, Mr. Nakahigashi.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So let's share that with our listeners, because Mr. Nakahigashi, he owns a restaurant. It's like a really totally local, sustainable. It's this Mr. Hisao Nakahigashi. He actually forages by himself.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like he's just doing his thing that his grandma did, and his, you know, and his grandmother's grandmother, and then the folks who he gets his vegetables from have been, you know, their family. They've been farming those plots for centuries. Mm. So, you know, we put these labels on. Oh, it's sustainable. It's local. It's this. It's that. You know, it's like you go to this rice rice grower, and he has ducks who eat the bugs instead of spraying it with pesticides. But, you know, I mean, that's just kind of a natural way of Japanese food, right? Mm-hmm. You know, of centuries. Mm-hmm. So before, you know, I mean, who discovered America? You know what I mean? So who discovered what local means? You know, I think that if you go to any traditional culture, you see that. And Mr. Nakahigashi really, he grew up in the mountains. I've been to where that guy grew up, and it was really, it takes a little while to get up to where he was as a kid. And he really did get that, all that knowledge. He's a botanist, basically. It's unbelievable going out into the, you know, the swamps and the forests and river banks and all that stuff with that guy, because he can identify all these plants. Mm. And I'll just say something funny. He came to New York to deliver some kind of some piece of kitchen equipment because he knows Masa, the Masa sushi guy. Mm-hmm. And he only could come for a couple of days because he had such a commitment to his customers and he didn't want to leave them. Mm. But he went to Central Park and he's like, wow, there's so much you can eat here. I'm like, that's pretty funny. But he, you know,
he's, ginkgo nuts, yeah, and exactly.
Oh, he saw all these herbs and all this other stuff that was growing. He's like, wow, you know, it's this and it's that. It was pretty funny.
Mm.
He was pretty, you know. He didn't go out to a restaurant.
Right.
No, I'm kidding.
Well, and yeah, well, but if the listeners are interested, his restaurant is called the Sojiki Nakahigashi. It's S-O-U-J-I-K-I Nakahigashi. It's N-A-K-A-H-I-G-A-S-H-I. And I think he has only 28 seats, a tiny restaurant. I haven't
I
been
think
there.
Less. It's I think there are 18 seats on the dining counter or something like that. And then, you know, there's a room upstairs, but... yeah, it's really tiny.
Mm.
But you know what's so nice about going to his restaurant? And again, this is such a testament to Japanese culture. I mean, I've had the great honor of eating there a number of times in my life. And, you know, it takes months to get a reservation. But it's not like going to Per Se, which is this, you know, it's kind of, you know, very rarefied and, you know, kind of like customers or the captains of industry or something like that. Mm. It's just people
right.
who love Japanese, like Japanese people who love Japanese food, you know, and who know about Mr. Nakahigashi. And it's like, it was really such a warm, beautiful experience every time I go there, because he's a funny guy anyway. I mean, I don't speak Japanese, but I see what's, you know, I can kind of vibe on everybody.
Mm.
And yeah, it's just people, you know, who... whatever, I you know, just made a reservation months ago, and then they could just sit down and have a really nice meal. But I think that's one of the things that really blew me away about Japan, too, is that there is such a sensitivity across the board. Like, if you ask the trash collector about what's in season right now, you know, what's shun, right? And, you know, I think, like, people can give you that answer. I mean, there's kind of an awareness that's part of being Japanese. And it doesn't mean you have to be, quote unquote, a foodie or whatever. You just have to be a person of Japanese culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a sense of, you know, it's really amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I always found so, you know, something that just really appealed to me about going to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I know, you know, Akiko, it's like every time you go anywhere in any train station in Japan, they have all these posters that are advertising places. But I always laugh because the biggest part of that poster is food. It's like,
it's true.
To this part in, you know, Akita Prefecture and we make, you know, X, Masu, the whatever, like, you know. And so food is within Japan is really such a big part of life. And the awareness is so great, you know, and that's one of the things that, you know, I mean, Mr. Nakahigashi is such a humble man, you know, and his farmers and all those folks. I mean, I've spent a lot of time with this guy over the years, and it's just, you know, it's not like, you know, somebody's bringing him, oh, these are our special vegetables that are sitting, you know, they're on a piece of slate and we're going to look at that.
Mm.
And it's like, it's just food, you know, but it's coming from, you know, where food should be.
Right. Yeah, it seems like I read a couple articles about him before, and he totally respects the nature. It's almost like Shintoism or something like that.
Yeah, but he's not on a religious trip, you know.
Right.
I mean, he's just kind of honoring that. And he always, you know, he always says this is... you know, this is what this ingredient should taste like.
Right.
This is what, you know, this vegetable.
Mm.
Or even how he kills chickens, because he slaughters his own chickens and he does it in a certain way that apparently doesn't, you know, in his mind doesn't shock them. And without, like, you know, the adrenaline coming out, right?
Mm.
So, you know, he has his system. He thinks about everything. It's kind of amazing.
Right. Yeah, I think the many chefs like him kind of has the attitude that you're given the ingredients by the nature.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think the whole Japanese society, like everybody, before you eat, you say itadakimasu,
right,
means thank you for
the
you know, all those giving from the nature.
Yeah, so. You take a second. I mean, we don't do it anymore. Anymore in this modern world that I exist in, you know, but I have a lot of different friends, and I have friends who are Mennonite farmers in you know, in Pennsylvania, and they sit down and they give blessing before the food. And I mean, I'm not a religious guy, but it's like, I really respect that. It's mm-hmm. like you take a minute to thank, you know, the creator, whoever, or whatever it is, or nature, that this came to you from somewhere. It didn't come out of a plastic bag, you know. It's right. like it was grown, it was raised, it's, you know, from nature, it's from somebody's hand, you know, tending to whatever, a chicken or, you know, a piece of celery.
Right.
So it's, yeah, it's, we forget that, I think, a little bit.
Well, but I was reviewing, you know, whatever you wrote before, and it's just amazing that, for instance, you had another article for, you stayed at Japanese Ryokan for Hemisphere magazine, for United Airlines magazine, and you saw the ryokan culture, and maybe you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did. I had a chance to stay in this great old ryokan in a place called Karatsu, which is another pottery center, which is why I was down there. And it's in Kyushu, which is kind of the deep south of Japan. It's really funny place that has its own subculture. I mean, one of the things that I realized, I learned, is that Japan is a place of many, you know, microcultures. And, you know, through history, most Japanese were not allowed to leave their area of their birth. So, you know, different parts of Japan have their own character and their own dialects, actually, and their own food and all kinds of sake and different things that are characterized different parts of Japan. So Kyushu has its own world. And, yeah, the ryokan was really very interesting. I mean, you know, as I, that was a while ago, and I have since learned more about Japanese culture, you know, and, you know, one of the things that is interesting about a place like that is that you're like a ryokan, is that there's kind of a way to, you know, to experience it. And, I mean, as an American, I was really interested in traditions.
Yeah,
and the fine
well,
food.
You actually described it. I couldn't help just copying this. As there, you know, inns are cultural time capsules, special places Japanese people go for one or two nights to connect with their traditions and take a relaxing break from modern life. And it was so well described.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are a lot of different places where you can kind of hit recharge as a Japanese person. Mm-hmm. And, for example, like if you fast forward a number of years, I mean, the funny thing about me, since I cooked and I started writing about this food, I thought, hey, you know, the only way you really write about something is if you start cooking, I mean, to understand it more. So I ended up cooking more, too, and I had an incredible opportunity to work in restaurants in Japan. And I worked in this really amazing place for a month in Kyoto called Hyote, which is over 400 years old. And it was like, you know, there was all this stuff when you have a meal at Hyote. And I thought, man, you're just like you're Japanese. You kind of come in there and you recharge your cultural battery, you know, like, you know, who you are. And it was amazing to watch. You know, of course, most of it was lost on me, but it was really interesting to observe.
Right. Well, I think through your assignments and experience in Japan, you became so interested in Japanese food that you built a website called JapaneseFoodReport.com. And it's amazing. Like, it's not just super informative, but you tell a lot of interesting stories about Japanese culture. So what's the motivation?
Well, you know what? I heard a lecture by this photographer, and she just passed away recently. Her name was Mary Ellen Mark. She's a really famous photographer. And she did all these incredible books about prostitutes in India and lepers, all kinds of stuff that were interesting to her. And so, you know, she was talking about how she got into that. And at the time, she was also a really successful photographer of Hollywood movies on their sets, like some of the most, you know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or some of those stills that are so timeless and were Mary Ellen Mark's work. And so she said, you know what, at the end of the day, she was really interested in, you know, all the stuff that she was interested in. And she said, screw it, I'm going to self-assign myself and do it. And I thought, you know, I was listening to that, I'm like, you know, I'm interested in Japanese world and I want to learn more about the food world. But you know, and I was very fortunate that Gourmet or The Times, you know, or Saveur would assign me a story, but they're covering the whole planet, so they're only going to write a little bit about Japan. And I can only, you know, I can't do more than a story or two every once in a while for any of those folks. So right. Why not assign myself, you know, this place to really to dig into it. And that's what I did. And I just did it really for myself, but it grew a following. And I still am amazed by, you know, people looking it up.
Yeah, it's really complete. I was really impressed how deep it is.
Well, you know, it's like I was trying to find a place. Look, I just did something yesterday. I was cooking for my son and a couple of friends, and I have a traditional rice cooker, which I hadn't used in a couple of years because I'm so busy with the other life of mine that I have now. And I looked it up, you know, because I knew I wrote about it, you know, in the last 10 years. So I thought, okay, this is what you do. You know? So it's my own personal reference library.
It should be globally.
Yeah. Well, it's out there. It's online, yeah. You know.
Okay. So, yeah, it's JapaneseFoodReport.com.
Yeah, right. And I haven't updated since 2012, but, you know, I'm going to get back to it someday.
Yeah, I hope so. Right. Okay, let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Harry's fabulous Japanese restaurants, so please stay with us.
Helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers in turn help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Harry Salad, who is a journalist and the owner of two popular Japanese restaurants, Ganso Ramen and Ganso Yaki in Brooklyn. So you opened the Ganso Ramen in September 2012, and it's a big jump from a writer to a restaurateur. So why did you decide to open a restaurant, and why it's a ramen shop?
Well, one of my customers came in the other day, and his first question is, do you miss being a freelance writer? So I didn't have a trust fund or a wealthy spouse, so I actually needed a real job. That's actually partially true. I didn't want to create a foundation to build a business. I wanted to do that for a long time, and the opportunity came. In downtown Brooklyn, which is going through an incredible change, but still there were ways to find a favorable lease to open a restaurant, and I talked a bunch of investors into backing me.
You planned to open a restaurant for a long time?
I thought about it I like the business. It's kind of crazy, like the news business, and I've always, one of my goals in life has been to have my own business, and for about 8 years or so I was trying to do it.
Wow.
Yeah, and then it came together.
Right. It happened to be a ramen shop.
That was by design, and it was also foolish. I thought, it's a popular restaurant, but I thought about ramen. I thought, well, a ramen would be very appealing, to an audience, and I was right about that. And ramen, you know, kind of blew up in New York just at that time. But it kind of happened around me. So my timing was really good about that. Mm. But what I didn't appreciate, and I appreciate now, is that ramen, to do really good ramen, and I care about what I do. You know, I don't want to just, you know, slop garbage onto a bowl. Mm. So to do good ramen is actually quite difficult. Mm. And it took, you know, I think we work hard every day still to do a great ramen. And I think our product is really amazing right now.
Right.
But it was an effort.
Yeah, it's an art. Like, I'm sure a lot of listeners have seen the movie Tampopo.
Yeah,
and
it's so funny.
An art.
Yeah, it is. And it, you know, and so you can choose how you want to do things. But we didn't want to, like, we create umami naturally, and we're making stock every day, and we're not, you know, pouring in 10 pounds of MSG or anything like that. So everything we're doing is we're pulling out, like, using, like, traditional Japanese stock ingredients like kombu or, you know, katsuobushi or sababushi, you know, dry shaved mackerel. Mm. And those are, you know, very potent umami ingredients. And then when you're boiling chicken bones and all that stuff, we make it with chicken bones. And it, you know, so it takes a while, and it really is kind of this effort, because it's all about the soup.
Mm.
And then, you know, all the other parts of ramen, but the soup is the foundation, you know.
Do you have a seat tonight?
Yeah, there we go.
Right. How did you prepare to run a restaurant? Did you work in a kitchen?
Well, I mean, I think the great thing, like, you know, for me is I've been a quick study. I did terrible in college. 2.24. Oh, did I say that? So I was probably too young to go to school in my head, I guess. But mm-hmm. I, you know, as I went out in life, I've always, like, journalism, everything I learned from masters that I met along the way, truly, and writing and all that stuff. I worked with great people. It was just accidental. When I came with the restaurant business, yes, I thought, well, two things. First of all, I started working with a gentleman who I still work with, and I just saw this morning, who's in his mid-80s and who's been in the restaurant business for a long time and is an incredible guy. And he's been advising me since I started this business. So I had a great mentor mm-hmm. and a business partner. So he's a great guy. And I love how he does business. I mean, his, you know, favorite word is equitable. Mm-hmm. He's a very honorable man, and which, you know, fits my philosophy and how we do business. So that, I was really lucky to find somebody like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then before we opened, I've been working in restaurants on and off anyway, but mm-hmm. then I have some friends who own a Japanese restaurant here in the city. And I said to them, hey, you know, let me volunteer as a manager there a few nights a week.
Mm.
So it got me back into the swing of things and really getting a sense of what I needed to do.
Right. So that's how you learn things, like you
exactly,
said.
Exactly, by doing it.
Right. Well, I was curious that you said you had a kitchen experience at Hyōte in Kyoto, and which is the peak of the pyramid of kaiseki cuisine in a way. But how did you get the job?
Well, the funny thing is that I, you know, Japan, I think, is like about, it's about hanging around, like, after a while. And I didn't know the people at Hyōte. I actually met them on some press things, you know, once or twice, but they didn't remember me. But I did strike up a nice friendship with these folks who have a knife shop in Kyoto, another place that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, Aritsugu.
Mm.
And they have great knives. And I took care of my knives, you know, and I would come back. I wrote a story about knives once, too, and I talked to those guys. But then I bought a couple of knives that I was using, and any time I came back to Japan, I brought them with me to get, you know, kind of maintained. But they were always like, wow, you know, you really take care of your knives. You're working on your shaping and all that other stuff. So, and the funny thing about all this is that there's another gentleman, Dr. Ishige. I don't know if you ever came across him. He's a historian of Japanese food. Mm-hmm. He's retired now. He was a professor at Kyoto University. Really amazing guy. And he wrote this book that's been translated into English, but just like I bought a copy. It was like $300. There were very few copies around. I can't remember the name of the book. And he talked about how they judged cooks back in the old days in Japan by how they didn't talk to them. They looked at their knives, and that told them everything. Mm. And so those guys were like, wow, we're impressed by how you shape your knives. And I had this idea about working in a kitchen in Japan. And I just, you know, in journalism, it's nothing ventured, nothing gained. You just ask people questions and you just ask. And mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, guys, you know where I can spend a month or two working in Kyoto, because I already had done something in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And they, on their own volition, I mean, they went and talked to the family that runs Hyote. And I mean, I don't speak Japanese, but I could follow a little bit of conversation. And I met them, and we had this meeting between the Aritsugu people, Hyote, and myself. And the man from gentleman from Aritsugu was talking about, like he was saying, the guy's always keeps his knife sharp and, you know, takes care of his knives. And I thought, man, you know, like I'm actually living Dr. Ishige's book right now. It's so funny. But then they did it. But I have to give them credit, because it was a big risk. And I think, like, everybody was a little bit like, you know, we're taking a flyer with this guy. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, Americans are really impulsive. That's not a Japanese trait, you know, per se. You know what I mean? That it's like, so, you know, who knows what I'm going to do? but, you know, I always come to Japan with respect and say, hey, you know, I'm not in Brooklyn right now. I'm back, you know, I'm in a different, wildly different culture. I mean, I'm born in Brooklyn. I'm like, you know, totally New York guy. And then Japan is that complete opposite of New York, especially if you're outside of any city, you know, and it couldn't be more different.
Right.
And, you know, for one of the first times I came back, it was, I was running around in Japan, and I met this journalist from a newspaper in Canada. And she's like, this is the most different place on the planet from an American or Canadian. And I'm like, yeah, it's really, but that's what makes it so appealing. Right. But yeah, so I mean, it was, you know, I respect the culture and the people, and it worked out great. I learned so much. My skills went through the roof in a month. I mean, I worked my butt off, but I did so much knife work, and it's, you know, it's in my hands now for the rest of my life.
Mm. You should put the name on the resume, like kitchen experience. That's really gold.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a month, you know, it's like, look, I'll just say this, like, you know, we have people, you know, like, they have a group of, you know, deshi or shugyo, right, apprentices, who are essentially like monks, and they work for, you know, 8 to 10 years as apprentices, and then they get out, and they call themselves chefs, and it's like, that's what it takes, you know, and you know, so it would be so presumptuous of me to even say anything, you know, just after a month. I mean, I learned a lot for myself, but
you know, a lot of people say, I worked at Airbnb, I worked at Noma.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I see that. I mean, I'm in the restaurant business. I see all these resumes, and I'm like, you know, you did work in those places, but I think it's like any craft. You have to really, like, it takes time, and then it becomes into your veins, you know, into who you are, and you start to kind of make it your own kung fu, basically. Whether you cook or you do martial arts or whatever it is, it's like, after a while, it's like kung fu means practice, right? Like do in Japanese, right? Mm-hmm. It's a constant practice, and cooking is the same way. And then after a while, you start to get kind of your own mojo. But it doesn't happen overnight, at least in my book. Yeah, maybe I'm getting old-fashioned, you know. But
but I'm very impressed that Aritsugu is really the best. People say the best. And
they're really nice people. The shacho there, the chairman of the company, he's a really feisty guy. He didn't like my stone, my cutting, you know, sharpening stone. He's like, get rid of that. It's garbage. He gave me some, like, just took one from the shop, and it's like, you can borrow it. Whatever. He was really funny. He had very strong feelings about his knives and what was right. And then the gentleman who ran the business, too, was such a lovely guy. And yeah, they were great.
Right. So speaking of people, I want to talk about, you know, how you have a business partner, Tadashi Ono.
Yeah, and I'm really fortunate to be.
Yeah, well, he used to be the executive chef at the Matsuri in the Meatpacking District, and he's now the Gansu's culinary director and business partner, right?
Yes.
So how did it happen, everything happened?
Well, I mean, I met Tadashi like I meet a million people. I interviewed him for something I was doing, and then but I was really impressed because Tadashi, of people that I met in New York, who in the Japanese culinary world had such an incredible ability to relate Western cooking to Japanese cooking, and it's and because he was a really successful French chef. You know, right. He's around my age, so at the time, like I'm in my early 50s, there was a lot of, you know, cooking Japanese on a high level anywhere in the United States. So if it wasn't sushi, so he came up in French, and then he wanted to, you know, really get back to his roots. So that's how we started.
Right. Yeah, he actually came to, of course, you know, he came to a show.
Yes.
Several episodes ago. And if you listeners, you haven't listened to it, you should, because Tadashi is amazing.
He is an amazing guy. You know, we wrote 3 cookbooks together. I love, you know, kind of talking to him about Japanese food, but he's also a great chef, and he knows how to run a kitchen and run a restaurant, and it's been an incredible partnership. Because you know what I love about Tadashi? He's an open book. He's a very nurturing man, and if you, you know, like our chefs at Ramen, you know, when we promoted one of our chefs, and I said to her, I said, look, you know, you have an opportunity. I mean, I'm a guy who's learned a lot from people. And, you know, and I thought, okay, you know, here's Tadashi. You're a cook. Just humble yourself and open yourself up to Tadashi and learn, because he wants to teach you. And she did that, and she's an amazing chef.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the Gansoyaki, because you and Tadashi opened it in March this year.
Right.
And do you call it izakaya?
Yeah, by default. You know, now it's an izakaya.
Right. Well, by the way, the izakaya, for listeners, it's a casual restaurant that serves Japanese alcohol and Japanese food to go with the drinks.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we've had that's the thing. It was a very interesting experience with Gansoyaki, because it's not sushi, it's not ramen, so, you know, as a culture in America, we like to categorize things, so what the hell is it? So it's kind of like an izakaya,
right.
You know, and there's drinks, and there's small plates, but there's, you know, it's a very casual kind of place to, you know, eat great food.
Right. Actually, I looked back to some history of izakaya, and until 1970s, izakaya restaurants were dominated by male salary men. But the industry really tried hard to attract women as well. So now you see men and women, even children.
We have a lot of families. You know, here's the thing. Like, you know, that whatever the label is, it gets turned into whatever America is. You know what I mean? So I think that, we have all kinds of people come in. You know, in the earlier part of the night, we have families coming with kids, because all the food is so appealing. Like, Japanese food is so delicious. So it's so easy to like.
Right. I think the izakaya, you know, if you go to izakaya in Japan or in your place, basically there's something for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's any occasion, birthday party or family gathering.
Yeah, or just kind of having a simple meal too, you know. And some, like, I used to go to this izakaya in Midtown. And there's a kind of like an area in the East 40s in Manhattan that has a lot of Japanese restaurants that serve the Japanese multinational companies that are located there. I could just sit down at the dining counter and have a great meal and not talk to anybody or whatever, you know, and just chill.
Right.
So people do that at our restaurant too. So from, you know, the whole gamut.
Yeah, I really like the Gansoyaki's energy, because it's just exactly like in Japan, which is very important to the Japanese whole society.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. You can let off some steam.
So, and I heard you're planning to open a sushi place.
Yeah, we're in construction right now. We finally are doing a sushi place. And we are building it right next door to Gansoyaki. And it's going to be called Sushi Ganso. What an imaginative name. But Sushi Ganso is going to be a lovely restaurant. Tadashi is, you know, talking to a number of chefs, but it's going to be a Japanese sushi restaurant. So it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be this rarefied thing where you have to speak in hushed tones when you walk in. It's going to be like the way Tadashi and I are, which is kind of have fun, have a great meal, enjoy yourself casual, but good food. We care about the food. So we're going to have really good sushi, but Japanese sushi, you know, I don't know, inside out, spinach rolls or whatever. You know what I mean? It's just going to be pretty straight Japanese sushi, but it's going to be tasty.
Okay. So when do you think it's going to open?
January. We're working building it right now. I was just there this morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
We're getting there.
Right. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Harris.
Thank you so much, Akiko. Nice to see you.
Well, good luck with the opening of Ganso Sushi.
Thank you.
Right. And listeners, if you'd like to know more about Harris restaurants, please visit the GansoNYC.com. That is GNSSONYC.com. And you should check out his wonderful Japanese food website, JapaneseFoodReport.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful website, so please visit our page. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. Also iTunes and the Stitcher podcast. So, and today's show was made possible by Santori, and our engineer is Jack Inslee. And I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.